and she will perhaps kiss some boy, not because she wants to, but because it will be fun to giggle about it with her girlfriends in study hall the next day. Marty's dad takes Marty in the van because the van has a built-in ramp he can use to get Marty in and out. Marty rolls down the ramp and then buzzes up and down the streets themselves in his chair. He carries his bag on his lap, and they go to all the houses on their road and then to a few houses downtown, the Collinses, the McKinneses, the Manchesters, the Millikens, the Eastons. There is a fishbowl full of candy corn inside the pub, Snickers bars at the Congregational Church Parsonage, and Chunky bars at the Baptist Parsonage. Then on to the Randolphs, the Quinns, the Dixons, and a dozen, two dozen more. Marty comes home with his bag of candy bulging, and a piece of scary, almost unbelievable knowledge. He knows. He knows who the werewolf is. At one point on Marty's tour, the beast himself, now safely between its moons of insanity, has dropped candy into his bag, unaware that Marty's face has gone deadly pale under his Don Post Yoda mask, or that beneath his gloves, his fingers are clutching his Yoda staff so tightly that the fingernails are white. The werewolf smiles at Marty and pats his rubber head. But it is the werewolf. Marty knows, and not just because the man is wearing an eye patch. There is something else, some vital similarity in this man's human face to the snarling face of the animal he saw on that silvery summer night almost 4 months ago now. Since returning to Tarker's Mills from Vermont the day after Labor Day, Marty has kept a watch, sure that he will see the werewolf sooner or later, and sure that he will know him when he does, because the werewolf will be a one-eyed man. Although the police nodded and said they would check it out when he told them he was pretty sure he had put out one of the werewolf's eyes, Marty could tell they didn't really believe him. Maybe that's because he is just a kid, or maybe it's because they weren't there on that July night when the confrontation took place. Either way, it doesn't matter. He knew it was so. Tarker's Mills is a small town, but it is spread out. And until tonight, Marty has not seen a one-eyed man, and he has not dared to ask questions. His mother is already afraid that the July episode may have permanently marked him. He is afraid that if he tries any out-and-out sleuthing, it will eventually get back to her. Besides, Tarker's Mills is a small town. Sooner or later, he will see the beast with his human face on. Going home, Mr. Coleslaw, Coach Coleslaw to his thousands of students past and present, thinks Marty is so quiet because the evening and the excitement of the evening has tired him out. In truth, this is not so. Marty has never, except on the night of the wonderful bag of fireworks, felt so awake and alive. And his principal thought is this. It had taken him almost 60 days after returning home to discover the werewolf's identity because he, Marty, is a Catholic and attends St. Mary's on the outskirts of town. The man with the eye patch, the man who dropped a chunky bar into his bag and then smiled and patted him on top of his rubber head, is not a Catholic. Far from it. The beast is the Reverend Lester Lowe of the Grace Baptist Church. Leaning out the door, smiling, Marty sees the eye patch clearly in the yellow lamplight falling through the door. It gives the mousy little reverend an almost piratical look.
"Sorry about your eye, Reverend Lowe," Mr. Coleslaw said in his booming big pal voice. "Hope it's nothing serious."
The Reverend Lowe's smile grew long-suffering. Actually, he said, he had lost the eye, a benign tumor. It had been necessary to remove the eye to get at the tumor, but it was the Lord's will, and he was adjusting well. He had patted the top of Marty's whole head mask again and said that some he knew had heavier crosses to bear. So now Marty lies in his bed, listening to the October wind sing outside, rattling the season's last leaves, hooting dimly through the eye-holes of the carven pumpkins which flank the coleslaw driveway, watching the half-moon ride the star-studded sky. The question is this: what is he to do now? He doesn't know, but he feels sure that in time the answer will come. He sleeps the deep, dreamless sleep of the very young, while outside the river of wind blows over Tarker's Mills, washing out October and bringing in cold, star-shot November, autumn's iron month. November. The smoking butt end of the year, November's dark iron, has come to Tarker's Mills. A strange exodus seems to be taking place on Main Street. The Reverend Lester Lowe watches it from the door of the Baptist parsonage. He has just come out to get his mail, and he holds six circulars and one single letter in his hand, watching the conga line of dusty pickup trucks, Fords and Chevys and International Harvesters snake its way out of town. Snow is coming, the weatherman says, but these are no riders before the storm, bound for warmer climes. You don't head out for Florida or California's golden shore with your hunting jacket on and your gun behind you in the cab rack and your dogs in the flatbed. This is the fourth day that the men, led by Elmer Zinneman and his brother Pete, have headed out with dogs and guns and a great many six-packs of beer. It is a fad that has caught on as the full moon approaches. Bird season's over, deer season too, but it's still open season on werewolves, and most of these men, behind the mask of their grim get-the-wagons-in-a-circle faces, are having a great time. As Coach Coleslaw might have said, doodly-damn right. Some of the men, Reverend Lowe knows, are doing no more than skylarking. Here is a chance to get out in the woods, pull beers, piss in ravines, tell jokes about Polacks and frogs and niggers, shoot at squirrels and crows. They're the real animals, Lowe thinks, his hand unconsciously going to the eye patch he has worn since July. Somebody will shoot somebody, most likely. They're lucky it hasn't happened already. The last of the trucks drives out of sight over Tarker's Hill, horn honking, dogs yarking and barking in the back. Yes, some of the men are just skylarking, but some, Elmer and Pete Zinneman, for example, are dead serious. If that creature, man or beast or whatever it is, goes hunting this month, the dogs will pick up its scent, the Reverend Lowe has heard Elmer say in the barbershop not 2 weeks ago, and if it or he don't go out, then maybe we'll have saved a life. Someone's livestock, at the very least. Yes, there are some of them, maybe a dozen, maybe two dozen, who mean business. But it is not them that has brought this strange new feeling into the back of Lowe's brain, that sense of being brought to bay. It's the notes that have done that. The notes, the longest of them only two sentences long, written in a childish, laborious hand, sometimes misspelled. He looks down at the letter that has come in today's mail, addressed in that same childish script, addressed as the others have been addressed, the Reverend Lowe, Baptist Parsonage, Tarker's Mills, Maine, 04491. Now this strange, trapped feeling, the way he imagines a fox must feel when it realizes that the dogs have somehow chased it into a cul-de-sac, that panicked moment that the fox turns, its teeth bared, to do battle with the dogs that will surely pull it to pieces. He closes the door firmly, goes inside to the parlor where the grandfather clock ticks solemn ticks and talks solemn talks. He sits down, puts the religious circulars carefully aside on the table Mrs. Miller polishes twice a week, and opens his new letter. Like the others, there is no salutation. Like the others, it is unsigned, written in the center of a sheet torn from a grade schooler's lined notepad is this sentence,
Why don't you kill yourself? The Reverend Lowe puts a hand to his forehead. It trembles slightly. With the other hand, he crumples the sheet of paper up and puts it in the large glass ashtray in the center of the table. Reverend Lowe does all of his counseling in the parlor, and some of his troubled parishioners smoke. He takes a book of matches from his Saturday afternoon at-home sweater and lights the note as he has lit the others. He watches it burn. Lowe's knowledge of what he is has come in two distinct stages. Following his nightmare in May, the dream in which everyone in the old home Sunday congregation turned into a werewolf, and following his terrible discovery of Clyde Corliss's gutted body, he has begun to realize that something is, well, wrong with him. He knows no other way to put it. Something wrong. But he also knows that on some mornings, usually during the period when the moon is full, he awakes feeling amazingly good, amazingly well, amazingly strong. This feeling ebbs with the moon, and then grows again with the next moon. Following the dream and Corliss's death, he has been forced to acknowledge other things which he had up until then been able to ignore. Clothes that are muddy and torn. Scratches and bruises he cannot account for. But since they never hurt or ache, as ordinary scratches and bruises do, they have been easy to dismiss, to simply not think about. He has even been able to ignore the traces of blood he has sometimes found on his hands and lips. Then on July 5th, the second stage. Simply described, he had awakened blind in one eye. As with the cuts and scratches, there had been no pain, simply a gored, blasted socket where his left eye had been. At that point, the knowledge had become too great for denial. He is the werewolf. He is the beast. For the last 3 days, he has felt familiar sensations, a great restlessness, an impatience that is almost joyful, a sense of tension in his body. It is coming again. The change is almost here again. Tonight the moon will rise full, and the hunters will be out with their dogs. Well, no matter, he is smarter than they give him credit for. They speak of a man-wolf, but think only in terms of the wolf, not the man. They can drive in their pickups, and he can drive in his small Volare sedan. And this afternoon he will drive down Portland way, he thinks, and stay at some motel on the outskirts of town. And if the change comes, there will be no hunters, no dogs. They are not the ones who frighten him. Why don't you kill yourself? The first note came early this month. It said simply, I know who you are. The second said, if you are a man of God, get out of town. Go someplace where there are animals for you to kill, but no people. The third said, end it. That was all, just end it. And now, why don't you kill yourself? Because I don't want to, the Reverend Lowe thinks petulantly. This, whatever it is nothing I asked for. I wasn't bitten by a wolf or cursed by a gypsy. It just happened. I picked some flowers for the vases in the church vestry one day last November, up by that pretty little cemetery on Sunshine Hill. I never saw such flowers before, and they were dead before I could get back to town. They turned black, every one. Perhaps that was when it started to happen. No reason to think so exactly. I do. And I won't kill myself. They are the animals, not me. Who is writing the notes? He doesn't know. The attack on Marty Koslaw has not been reported in the weekly Tarker's Mills newspapers, and he prides himself on not listening to gossip. Also, as Marty did not know about Lowe until Halloween because their religious circles do not touch, the Reverend Lowe does not know about Marty. and he has no memory of what he does in his beast state, only that alcoholic sense of well-being when the cycle has finished for another month, and the restlessness before. I am a man of God, he thinks, getting up and beginning to pace, walking faster and faster in the quiet parlor where the grandfather clock ticks solemn ticks and talks solemn talks. I am a man of God, and I will not kill myself. I do good here, and if I sometimes do evil, why, men have done evil before me. Evil also serves the will of God, or so the book of Job teaches us. If I have been cursed from outside, then God will bring me down in his time. All things serve the will of God. And who is he? Shall I make inquiries? Who was attacked on July 4th? How did I, it, lose his, its, I? Perhaps he should be silenced, but not this month. Let them put their dogs back in their kennels first. Yes. He begins to walk faster and faster, bent low, unaware that his beard, usually scant, he can get away with only shaving once every 3 days, at the right time of the month, that is, has now sprung out thick and scruffy and wiry, and that his one brown eye has gone a hazel shade that is deepening moment by moment toward the emerald green it will become later this night. He is hunching forward as he walks, and he has begun to talk to himself. But the words are growing lower and lower, more and more like growls. At last, as the gray November afternoon tightens down toward an early anvil-colored dusk, he bounds into the kitchen, snatches the Volare's keys from the peg by the door, and almost runs toward the car. He drives toward Portland fast, smiling, and he does not slow when the season's first snow starts to skirl into the beams of his headlights, dancers from the iron sky. He senses the moon somewhere above the clouds. He senses its power. His chest expands, straining the seams of his white shirt. He tunes the radio to a rock and roll station, and he feels just great. And what happens later that night might be a judgment from God or a jest of those older gods that men worshipped from the safety of stone circles on moonlit nights. Oh, it's funny, all right, pretty funny. Because Lo has gone all the way to Portland to become the beast, and the man he ends up ripping open on that snowy November night is Milt Sturmfuller, a lifelong resident of Tarker's Mills. And perhaps God is just after all, because if there is a first-class grade-A shit in Tarker's Mills, it is Milt Sturmfuller. He has come in this night, as he has on other nights, telling his battered wife, Donna Lee, that he is on business, but his business is a B-girl named Rita Tennyson, who has given him a lively case of herpes, which Milt has already passed on to Donna Lee, who has never so much as looked at another man in all the years they have been married. The Reverend Lowe has checked into a motel called the Driftwood near the Portland-Westbrook line, and this is the same motel that Milt Sturmfuller and Rita Tennyson have chosen on this November night to do their business. Milt steps out at 10:15 to retrieve a bottle of bourbon he's left in the car, and he is, in fact, congratulating himself on being far from Tarker's Mills on the night of the full moon, when the one-eyed beast leaps on him from the roof of a snow-shrouded Peterbilt ten-wheeler and takes his head off with one gigantic swipe. The last sound Milt Sturmfuller hears in his life is the werewolf's rising snarl of triumph. His head rolls under the Peterbilt, the eyes wide, the neck spraying blood, and the bottle of bourbon drops from his jittering hand as the beast buries its snout in his neck and begins to feed. And the next day, back in the Baptist parsonage in Tarker's Mills and feeling just great, the Reverend Lowe will read the account of the murder in the newspaper and think piously,
he was not a good man. All things serve the Lord. And following this, he will think, who is the kid sending the notes? Who was it in July? It's time to find out. It's time to listen to some gossip. The Reverend Lester Lowe readjusts his eye patch, shakes out a new section of the newspaper, and thinks, all things serve the Lord. If it's the Lord's will, I'll find him and silence him forever. December. It is 15 minutes of midnight on New Year's Eve. In Tarker's Mills, as in the rest of the world, the year is drawing to its close. And in Tarker's Mills, as in the rest of the world, the year has brought changes. Milt Sturmfuller is dead, and his wife Donna Lee, at last free of her bondage, has moved out of town. Gone to Boston, some say. Gone to Los Angeles, others say. Another woman has tried to make a go of the corner bookshop and failed, but the barber shop, the market basket, and the pub are doing business as the same old places, thank you very much. Clyde Corliss is dead, but his two good-for-nothing brothers, Alden and Errol, are still alive and well and cashing in their food stamps at the A&P two towns over. They don't quite have the nerve to do it right here in the mills. Grandma Haig, who used to make the best pies in Tarker's Mills, has died of a heart attack. Willie Harrington, who is 92, slipped on the ice in front of his little house on Ball Street late in November and broke his hip. But the library has received a nice bequest in the will of a wealthy summer resident, and next year construction will begin on the children's wing that has been talked about in town meetings since time out of mind. Ollie Parker, the school principal, had a nosebleed that just wouldn't quit in October and is diagnosed as an acute hypertensive. Lucky you didn't blow your brains out, the doctor grunted, unwrapping the blood pressure cuff, and told Ollie to lose 40 pounds. For a wonder, Ollie loses 20 of those pounds by Christmas. He looks and feels like a new man. Acts like a new man, too, his wife tells her close friend Delia Burney, with a lecherous little grin. Brady Kincaid, killed by the beast in kite-flying season, is still dead. And Marty Koslaw, who used to sit right behind Brady in school, is still a cripple. Things change. Things don't change. And in Tarker's Mills, the year is ending as the year came in. A howling blizzard is roaring outside, and the beast is around. Somewhere. Sitting in the living room of the Koslaw home and watching Dick Clark's Rockin' New Year's Eve are Marty Koslaw and his Uncle Al. Uncle Al is on the couch. Marty is sitting in his wheelchair in front of the TV. There is a gun in Marty's lap, a .38 Colt Woodsman. Two bullets are chambered in the gun, and both of them are pure silver. Uncle Al has gotten a friend of his from Hamden, Mac McCutcheon, to make them in a bullet loader. This Mac McCutcheon, after some protests, has melted Marty's silver confirmation spoon down with a propane torch and calibrated the weight of powder needed to propel the bullets without sending them into a wild spin. I don't guarantee they'll work, this Mac McCutcheon has told Uncle Al, but they probably will. What you gonna kill, Al? A werewolf or a vampire? One of each, Uncle Al says, giving him his grin right back. That's why I got you to make two. There was a banshee hanging around as well, but his father died in North Dakota, and he had to catch a plane to Fargo. They have a laugh over that, and then Al says, they're for a nephew of mine. He's crazy over movie monsters, and I thought they'd make an interesting Christmas present for him. Well, if he fires one into a batten, bring it back to the shop, Mac tells him. I'd like to see what happens. In truth,
Uncle Al doesn't know what to think. He hadn't seen Marty or been to Tarker's Mill since July 3rd. As he could have predicted, his sister, Marty's mother, is furious with him about the fireworks. "He could have been killed, you stupid asshole. What in the name of God did you think you were doing?" she shouts down the telephone wire at him. "Sounds like it was the fireworks that saved his..." Al begins, but there is the sharp click of a broken connection in his ear. His sister is stubborn. When she doesn't want to hear something, she won't. Then, early this month, a call came from Marty. "I have to see you, Uncle Al," Marty said. "You're the only one I can talk to."
"I'm in the doghouse with our mom, kid," Al answered.
"It's important," Marty said. "Please, please." So he came, and he braved his sister's icy, disapproving silence, and on a cold, clear, early December day, Al took Marty for a ride in his sports car, loading him carefully into the passenger bucket. Only this day there was no speeding and no wild laughter, only Uncle Al listening as Marty talked. Uncle Al listened with growing disquiet as the tale is told. Marty began by telling Al again about the night of the wonderful bag of fireworks and how he had blown out the creature's left eye with the black cat firecrackers. Then he told him about Halloween and the Reverend Lowe. Then he told Uncle Al that he had begun sending the Reverend Lowe anonymous notes, anonymous, that is, until the last two, following the murder of Milt Sturmfuller in Portland. Those he signed just as he had been taught in English class. "Yours truly, Martin Coleslaw."
"You shouldn't have sent the man notes, anonymous or otherwise," Uncle Al said sharply. "Christ, Marty, did it ever occur to you that you could be wrong?"
"Sure it did," Marty said. "That's why I signed my name to the last two." "Aren't you going to ask me what happened? Aren't you going to ask me if he called up my father and told him I'd sent him a note saying, 'Why don't you kill yourself?' and another one saying, 'We're closing in on you?'"
"He didn't do that, did he?"
Al asked, knowing the answer already.
"No," Marty said quietly. "He hasn't talked to my dad, and he hasn't talked to my mom, and he hasn't talked to me."
"Marty, there could be 100 reasons for the..."
"No, there's only one. He's the werewolf. He's the beast. It's him. And he's waiting for the full moon. As the Reverend Lowe, he can't do anything, but as the werewolf, he can do plenty. He can shut me up."
And Marty spoke with such chilling simplicity that Al was almost convinced.
"So what do you want from me?" Al asked.
Marty told him. He wanted 2 silver bullets and a gun to shoot them with, and he wanted Uncle Al to come over on New Year's Eve, the night of the full moon.
"I'll do no such thing," Uncle Al said. "Marty, you're a good kid, but you're going loopy. I think you've come down with a good case of wheelchair fever. If you think it over, you'll know it."
"Maybe," Marty said. "But think how you'll feel if you get a call on New Year's Day saying I'm dead in my bed, chewed to pieces. Do you want that on your conscience, Uncle Al?" Al started to speak, then closed his mouth with a snap. He turned into a driveway, hearing the Mercedes' front wheels crunch in the new snow. He reversed and started back. He fought in Vietnam and won a couple of medals there. He had successfully avoided lengthy entanglements with several lusty young ladies, and now he felt caught and trapped by his 10-year-old nephew. His crippled 10-year-old nephew. Of course he didn't want such a thing on his conscience, not even the possibility of such a thing. And Marty knew it. As Marty knew that if Uncle Al thought there was even 1 chance in 1,000 that he might be right, 4 days later, on December 10th, Uncle Al called. "Great news," Marty announced to his family, wheeling his chair back into the family room. "Uncle Al's coming over for New Year's Eve."
"He certainly is not," his mother said in her coldest, brusquest tone.
Marty was not daunted.
"Gee, sorry, I already invited him," he said. "He said he'd bring party powder for the fireplace."
His mother had spent the rest of the day glaring at Marty every time she looked in his direction or he in hers,
But she didn't call her brother back and tell him to stay away, and that was the most important thing. At supper that night, Katie whispered hissingly in his ear, "You always get what you want, just because you're a cripple." Grinning, Marty whispered back, "I love you too, sis." "You little booger!" She flounced away. And here it is, New Year's Eve. Marty's mother was sure Al wouldn't show up as the storm intensified, the wind howling and moaning and driving snow before it. Truth to tell, Marty has had a few bad moments himself, but Uncle Al arrived up around 8, driving not his Mercedes sports car, but a borrowed four-wheel drive. By 11:30, everyone in the family has gone to bed, except for the two of them, which is pretty much as Marty has foreseen things. And although Uncle Al is still poo-pooing the whole thing, he has brought not one but two handguns, concealed under his heavy CPO coat. The one with the two silver bullets he hands wordlessly to Marty after the family has gone to bed, as if to complete making the point Marty's mother slammed the door of the bedroom she shares with Marty's dad when she went to bed, slammed it hard. The other is filled with more conventional lead loads, but Al reckons that if a crazy man is going to break in here tonight, and as time passes and nothing happens, he comes to doubt that more and more, the 45 Magnum will stop him. Now on the TV, they are switching the cameras more and more often to the big lighted ball on top of the Allied Chemical Building in Times Square. The last few minutes of the year are running out. The crowd cheers. In the corner opposite the TV, the coleslaw Christmas tree still stands, drying out now, getting a little brown, looking sadly denuded of its presence. "Marty, nothing," Uncle Al begins. And then the big picture window in the family room blows inward in a twinkle of glass, letting in the howling black wind from outside, twisting skirls of white snow, and the beast. Al is frozen for a moment, utterly frozen with horror and disbelief. It is huge, this beast, perhaps 7 feet tall, although it is hunched over, so that its front hand paws almost drag on the rug. It's one green eye, just like Marty said, he thinks numbly, all of it, just like Marty said, glares around with a terrible rolling sentience and fixes upon Marty sitting in his wheelchair. It leaps at the boy, a rolling howl of triumph exploding out of its chest and past its huge yellow-white teeth. Calmly, his face hardly changing, Marty raises the .38 pistol. He looks very small in his wheelchair, his legs like sticks inside his soft and faded jeans, his fur-lined slippers on feet that have been numb and senseless all of his life. And, incredibly, over the werewolf's mad howling, over the wind's screaming, over the clap and clash of his own tottering thoughts about how this can possibly be in a world of real people and real things, over all of this, Al hears his nephew say, "Poor old Reverend Lowe, I'm going to try to set you free." And as the werewolf leaps, its shadow a blob on the carpet, its claw-tipped hands outstretched, Marty fires. Because of the lower powder load, the gun makes an almost absurdly insignificant pop. It sounds like a Daisy air rifle. But the werewolf's roar of rage spirals up into an even higher register, a lunatic screech of pain now. It crashes into the wall, and its shoulder punches a hole right through to the other side. A Currier and Ives painting falls onto its head, skates down the thick pelt of its back, and shatters as the werewolf turns. Blood is pouring down the savage, hairy mask of its face, and its green eye seems rolling and confused. It staggers toward Marty, growling, its claw hands opening and closing, its snapping jaws cutting off wads of blood-streaked foam. Marty holds the gun in both hands, as a small child holds his drinking cup. He waits. Waits. And as the werewolf lunges again, he fires. Magically, the beast's other eye blows out like a candle in a storm wind. It screams again and staggers, now blind, toward the window. The blizzard riffles the curtains and twists them around its head. Al can see flowers of blood begin to bloom on the white cloth as, on the TV, the big lighted ball begins to descend its pole. The werewolf collapses to its knees as Marty's dad, wild-eyed and dressed in bright yellow pajamas, dashes into the room. The .45 Magnum is still in Al's lap. He has never so much as raised it. Now, the beast collapses, shudders once, and dies. Mr. Coleslaw stares at it, open-mouthed. Marty turns to Uncle Al, the smoking gun in his hands. His face looks tired, but at peace. Happy New Year, Uncle Al, he says. It's dead. The beast is dead. And then he begins to weep. On the floor, under the mesh of Mrs. Coleslaw's best white curtains, the werewolf has begun to change. The hair, which has shagged its face and body, seems to be pulling in somehow. The lips, drawn back in a snarl of pain and fury, relax and cover the shrinking teeth. The claws melt magically away to fingernails, fingernails that have been almost pathetically gnawed and bitten. The Reverend Lester Lowe lies there, wrapped in a bloody shroud of curtain, snow blowing around him in random patterns. Uncle Al goes to Marty and comforts him as Marty's dad gawks down at the naked body on the floor and as Marty's mother, clutching the neck of her robe, creeps into the room. Al hugs Marty tight, tight, tight. You done good, kid, he whispers. I love you. Outside, the wind howls and screams against the snow-filled sky, and in Tarker's Mills, the first minute of the new year becomes history. Afterward. Any dedicated moon watcher will know that, regardless of the year, I have taken a good many liberties with the lunar cycle, usually to take advantage of days, Valentine's, July 4th, etc., which mark certain months in our minds. To those readers who feel that I didn't know any better, I assert that I did. But the temptation was simply too great to resist. Stephen King, August 4th, 1983. End of Cycle of the Werewolf by Stephen King. Read by Nick Sullivan in the studios of American Foundation for the Blind, Incorporated, for the Library of Congress, July 2006.